the fulfillment of infinite destiny. But its destiny is not the destiny of the psychic monad, which may be regarded as the governor of that body. Consequently, the body is composed always of self-sufficient units that are not truly dependent upon each other, but which are held in a relationship by a superior psychic monad, which we call the soul. The soul, by so uniting these monads, attains a new unity for itself. But in so doing, it does not injure or in any way detract from the totality of the parts which are used to make up its structure. If, therefore, this structure should cease or die, then these various monadal lives or atomic lives are simply released again into their own natural existence. Now comes a good question. Supposing a monad or atom is incorporated into the big toe of some human being. That human being dies. The disintegration that follows means the liberation of this atom or monad, which then returns to another state and awaits reincorporation into some other structure. Does the atom know that it has ever been in anybody's toe? This is a very vital question if you're an atom. This suddenly takes on grave importance. It might be the same way as asking, assume that man is an atom or a compound monad, and that man himself is in some way involved in the structure of a being so immense that man cannot comprehend the nature of that being. That perhaps man is also an atom in the toe of some infinite cosmic form. Man, because no being is capable of comprehending that which is essentially its superior, man, therefore, has no way of knowing the nature of that which is superior to himself. He only has a way of knowing his own kind and that which is inferior to himself and over which he has gained the victory of comprehension. Therefore, man can know other men. He can also gradually master the mysteries of lower forms of life around him. But he is not able to ascend to a quality state superior to himself. Therefore, he can explore the universe only on a level or on a plane. He can go as far as matter will take him. But if he loses contact with the kind of matter with which he is familiar, he loses orientation and consciousness. So the great doubt remains as to where man fits into this vast monadal structure. But for practical purposes, it is next assumed, perhaps borrowing a little from the Muslim again, that these various atoms or monads, by laws innate within themselves, are drawn together to form various arrangements and designs. And that in this process, they become ensouled by superior monadic principles. And that in this sense also we see how a certain number of atoms uniting together to form molecules thereby come under the psychic unity of a molecule. This psychic unity exists only so long as the atoms remain in this relationship. And with their separation, the molecule itself ceases. This brought not only Leibniz, but also the great French philosopher René Descartes and the Baconian theory into a new focus, because something has gradually been added to the picture. And the next problem that confronted these intellectuals was to solve certain inevitable doubts that all of this thinking generated. One of these doubts lay in a certain phenomena which was observed. And that was a phenomena which we may call contraction and expansion. Or we may also perhaps refer to it in another way, as evaporation or condensation. In other words, in the actual experimenting in the laboratory and in the compounding of chemical substances, it had been observed that certain changes take place, and the methods by which these changes can be estimated were not adequate. So something had to be done about it. This type of situation then caused a well-known simile, which has extended down through the centuries, namely that your atoms can be likened to a group of persons. In other words, you have 100 atoms gathering in the public park for a picnic. These atoms have now gathered around the luncheon table, and we might say are in a state of congestion, later perhaps indigestion, but now only congestion. This group of 100 has gradually come together as tightly as it could, forming an ever smaller group. As soon as lunch is over, an expansive process goes into action. These people begin to separate and to perhaps take on various activities. They decide they'll play games or they will take walks along the countryside, and your unit enlarges, becoming less dense as it enlarges. Somewhere along the line also, two or three families composing this unit decide to go home. So they walk right out of the compound entirely, and we even now use the same slang phrase that was used 300 years ago for the atom. We say these people evaporate. They disappear. Now, after they have been gone for a while, two or three other families that were late in getting an invitation to the picnic or got lost trying to find it move in, producing what we may call the opposite of evaporation, and that is precipitation. Someone new comes into the compound, and this compound is in a constant state, therefore, of motion. Now, we know in the study of the problem that this motion exists, that in motion and in nature, these expansive and contractive processes do go on. And the medieval and early modern atomists decided that it was easier to assume that these atoms could separate and come together than it was to assume that some kind of agglutinous mass, which had no separate unit parts, could expand and contract. This meant that the selection for the expansion and contraction theory was the atom rather than the continuum, because the continuum represented a substance which would have to expand and contract within the continually interfering boundaries of itself, whereas the atom could expand and contract in a vacuum or in space, or in any substance less gross or less precipitated than itself. This then caused also a very pleasant and interesting by thought to come in, and that was that the expansion and contraction of these atoms, like the story of the picnickers, also implied another element present, namely air. If the picnicker left his group, he was, so to say, displaced. Something took his place. When one person left the group, he did not leave vacuum behind him. Not even the vacuum is left by his own body. His own displacement was immediately filled. The next thing that was regarded as interesting and vital was that there was no proof that although these atoms got nearer and nearer together or became more and more separated, there was no actual factual proof that they ever actually touched. Now, the ancients thought that they did. The ancients thought that they hooked into each other in some cases, or that by certain kinds of gravitational pull they were drawn together, or that by a peculiar qualitative likeness they had a psychic attraction for each other, a move together. But then came the later question, is this necessary? Are we dealing with any substance sufficiently dense that we can demonstrate beyond doubt that there is no space between its atoms? And the 17th century philosopher-scientists, still working entirely by their own inductive procedures, came to the conclusion that although substances appeared to be solid, that there was no proof that every substance was not largely space, just as the human body is largely water, and that the atoms, so-called, making solid substances really are only relatively nearer or further from each other. That if they are relatively a little nearer, the invisible becomes visible. If they are relatively a little further apart, the visible becomes invisible. The boundary line in this pattern of coordination is so abstract that we can only say that a certain degree of pattern we can see, and a certain degree of pattern we cannot see. Also, the question then naturally comes up as to the relationship between the space occupied by atom and the actual displacement by atom. And it is assumed that the atoms in a pattern occupy a space much greater than their displacement, and therefore that they exist within an area or an environment which permeates between them, extends around them, and so to say forms their most immediate and intimate relationship. Now, if you have a group of such atoms, and each atom is, as Leibniz insists, alive, that there is a root core of spirit energy in every atom, you bring these atoms into compound. You bring them nearer and nearer together. You form out of them, for instance, a hollow sphere or something similar to that, or perhaps a solid sphere. But this solid sphere is only relatively solid. It is solid in the sense that it has become visible, tangible, cognizable by us, but actually no two of its atomic particles actually touch. But if they are near enough to give the impression of a solid, then comes the question, what is the effect of the life principle in each of these monads upon this solid? Does this life principle result in a kind of induction? Is there an energy field set up by magnetic chemistry involving this new unit of atomic organization? Does this fact that these forms are alive, even though they are infinitely minute, cause the compound to experience some kind of animation also? Is it possible that as the physical elements reach a certain design, that the core energies of these elements are then also brought into a relationship, and that by this relationship, certain psychic factors or psychic energies can also be released into manifestation? Leibniz thought they could. Most of the philosophers of that period more or less suspected that what we call the soul is really this interplay of psychic polarities of atoms. This was accepted rather early by the materialists, and it is still more or less accepted on the level of materialistic sciences. The soul is still a byproduct. It is still something which originates in the chemistry of the body, yet is superior to this chemistry in rational and emotional potential, but cannot survive the dissolution of this chemistry by death. So that the soul does represent a kind of higher energy released from matter. Leibniz took the form, rather, of the reverse, namely that the monad, or the atom, in its physical sense, was released from its own spiritual root, or spiritual source. Going back again for a few moments, then, to Leibniz, because we want to clear two or three other points in connection with his thinking, we have a mystical atomism gradually developing. We have now the concept that deity is atomic, that there is a sovereign archetypal atomic entity which is called the Absolute, that this Absolute is the perfect, all-powerful atom, that this might also be regarded as the ancestral atom, the atom from which atoms come. There is some question as to how Leibniz attempted to solve this point. He rather assumed, I think, the existence of an absolute, and that this absolute, by its own absoluteness, could not be subjected to any further investigation or analysis, that it represented an existing, totally continuing, always enduring totality, and that it was a compound or universal atom, the monad, the great monad. That this monad was essentially a spiritual being or a spiritual thing, but that in its totality it was inwardly spiritual, outwardly physical, and between these polarities, psychical. So that this monad contained a center, a radius, and a circumference. And for practical purposes, the center was spiritual, the radius was psychic, and the circumference was physical. Thus, all things that would exist in plane or condition exist in the monad. This monad, being absolute, might be considered the universal structure, or it may be considered the pattern for all lesser structures. Leibniz has this one other borrowing from antiquity, namely, to him, all these monads were microcosms of this greater monad. And all monads, therefore, are microcosmic facsimiles of their superiors, or those larger powers from which they are suspended. In this sense, perhaps the suggestion of Plotinus, the Neoplatonist, who describes the gods as effulgent blossoms from which the worlds are suspended. These effulgent blossoms, like the chakras of India, might be regarded as monadal. They may be regarded as living units of force and existence. Each of these, therefore, having its own psychic life, we come finally to man. Now, man is a creature with an internal nature. This we appreciate. He is also a creature with an external nature, and we are inclined to assume that this external nature is the greater reality of man. We see it, we clothe it, we feed it, therefore it is. Actually, according to Leibniz, this material form is simply the wall of a monad. The body is a kind of wall, dividing the monad from space. And each monad exists as a self in space. Now, this has no bearing upon whether there are 50,000 of these monads assembled at the Colosseum to watch a very strenuous baseball game or something of that kind. This has no bearing upon it. For each being, existence consists of self and space. That's all there really is. The rest of the relationship of existence is an emotionalization of these facts. the individual can create within himself explanations of relationships. But these relationships have no existence except in the explanations that he gives them. Thus, a man may say, by way of association, referring to a neighboring monad, "This is my friend." The other monad may agree with him on this particular point and say, "Well, I think that's pretty nice. I'll also be your friend." Now we have two friendly monads. These two friendly monads seemingly have come to some way by which the space interval between them has been reduced. But actually, although it may be reduced, it can never be eliminated. And according to Leibniz, these two monads that have physically shaken hands and are going to be pals from now on actually can never meet. It is utterly impossible. They can have certain physical symptoms or symbolisms of meeting, but they cannot actually meet. For neither of these monads can experience the other in the least degree. Neither of these monads can live the life of the other in the slightest degree. They can never coalesce. They can never become one being. They can never share together the intimate experiences of any form of psychic consciousness. All they can do is try to understand each other from the outside. All they can say is, more or less to themselves, "If he is as I am, this is the way he will act." This is the basis of the great disappointment of life, because the other fellow is not ourselves. Therefore, he does not act according to our expectancy. Therefore, we do not like him anymore. But we bestow upon him an explanation of himself, which is nothing but an interpretation of ourselves. We can do nothing with it. He may live in the same house. He may eat at the same table. We may be married to him for 40 years, but the space interval cannot be eliminated because the monad has no windows and no doors. It is a completely psychologically introverted existence. Its so-called extroversion is merely a function of its own imagination. Extroversion has really very little to do with the world on the outside. It has only to do with our reaction to that world. So the monad, never being able to be anything but itself, never being able to escape from itself, can never actually satisfy its own need in any way outside of itself. Now here we get to a philosophy situation that is quite reminiscent of Buddhism. Because in Buddhism, the last words of the teacher before the Nirvana were simply these: "Work out your salvation with diligence." It was an essential principle of Buddhism that no individual could be saved by another. And as far as that goes, no individual could come to any permanent measure of contentment or of good or of security or of insight as the result of the intercession of another being. Later this was modified in Buddhism, but in the primitive form, this was essentially the concept. So now we have Leibniz working with the isolated, bottled monad, encapsulated within its own existence. But, says Leibniz, there is nothing necessary to the perfection of this life that is not already within it. Therefore, perfection is a power inevitably resident in the monad itself. There is nothing that the being requires that the monad itself cannot provide. and that the entire situation is, therefore, one of immediately recognizing the true source of security and moving toward it. The individual, without calling upon the resources of his own intelligence, may ask the advice of others and later regret it. Whereas, had he realized that he possessed the basic intelligence, he would have known that he could develop the quality by which he could solve his own problem. The lonely monad, reaching out to find companionship, finds actually the only possible enduring companionship within its own existence, and that is its association with the divine or absolute monad at the root of itself. Thus, all exterior things are but symbols, and according to Leibniz, have values only because of our own interpretation. If the interpretive mind of man suddenly lost all of its glamorizing processes and simply faced fact, the world would turn into a pale gray haze. Nothing would continue to have any significance or importance whatsoever. But this is not the way man functions. Therefore, under the condition of his existing consciousness, he has to divide. He therefore has to have a world in being and a world in seeming. And this, again, goes back to your very early philosophical doctrines of Parmenides. The world of being is the world of the monad. The world of seeming is the world by means of which, by his conduct, man denies the totality of his own being and seeks outside of himself for the fulfillment of life. Thus you can understand how the concept of the atom, or the concept of the monad, began to affect the philosophical thinking of man, how it began to affect his belief in immortality, how it affected his moral and ethical life. And we can go back to Leibniz, because Leibniz now also has for our consideration the moral atom. Actually, good is one of the natural attributes of the atom. The atom is by nature good, by nature dedicated to the fulfillment of the divine pattern which is locked within itself. The monad unfolds as the human body unfolds, as the original covering of the primordial cell expands through cell fission in the human body, it finally becomes the epidermis. And the skin with which we observe the body to be covered is nothing more or less than the gradual enlarging, increasing, and expanding of the original wall of the first cell from which this being was created. So that the monad, though it may expand, the walls of it never break. Division takes place within it, as Pythagoras says, but itself it is not divided. So the monad is always a symbol of unity, which is not broken up or lost by the multiplication of parts, leading in their turn to the increase of size, body, or volume. This suggests a good many different points, but we're getting now gradually to one that has to have the greatest primary interest to us because of the situations that have developed. We began way back with the Greeks by thinking only of monad and vacuum, or atom and vacuum. We gradually came down through various levels of thinking in which the atom is merely a speck of this or a speck of that, or is the unit stone from which compounds are fashioned, regarded as stone, as sand, as matter, as substance, as material. And it came to be assumed that all physical things were composed of physical substances. But now Leibniz gives us the next interesting clue. And while he did not possess the formulas, he did possess a measure of the insight, which was to affect the study of atomism in more recent times. He suddenly recognized that the atom was essentially not matter, that the atom was life, that the unit was not a material or a substance, but an energy. Now, this was the beginning, really, of something that was to take form later. That actually this monad, to which he referred so frequently, was a spiritual being embodied, even though this being was very tiny and the body was infinitesimal. We can't even see it. Still, this unit monad was primarily life. And in this life, it was primarily linked to absolute life. Now, this requires only one more step to continue this process of chain reaction. In the Leibniz theory, following in this case certain of the earlier Greeks, each degree or level of monad was suspended from a superior by which it was also ensouled. And the life of a superior flowed into the inferior. But because the life of the superior was X and the life of the inferior was less than X, the larger or superior monad had to create a number of lesser monads, the total of this lesser group being able to accept and be ensouled by the X. In other words, if the lesser monad was only one-tenth the power of the greater, then it would be necessary to have 10 of these lesser ones to diffuse the power of the greater one through them. But the power so diffused by emanation, and we can go to the Gnostics for this theory, the power so diffused was not lost to the older or higher monad. So this monad simply experienced a division but was not divided, and its energy was diffused through 10 interior divisions of itself. In turn, these 10 each would require a certain number, perhaps another 10, on the next lower level, or the next level of reduction in volume and energy, and so on down. But through all of these different size groups, all these different emanation groups, from the lowest to the highest, went one thread. As described in the Gita, the single thread binding together all the beads of the rosary. This means that if you touch energy anywhere, you touch at the same time energy everywhere. Because anywhere is merely a hypothetical monadal unit in everywhere. And everywhere is an infinite number of anywheres. Each of these separate parts being and vitalized by one common energy. Leibniz, by transforming the atom from a particle of matter to a point of energy in space, prepared the way for the more complicated thinking of modern times. He prepared the way for the concept of chain reaction. He prepared the way for the realization of the universalization of the sick atom, or the universalization of the injury to the atom. He prepared the way for a very elaborate theory and philosophy of the interdependence of life. For he pointed out in this simple manner that anything is a door to everything. and that all this process moves inward, not outward. That therefore, to touch the energy core of any living thing is actually to touch the energy core of the Absolute itself. The Absolute is not one place and the finite in another place. Actually, the finite is merely the extension of the Absolute. And that any point anywhere in space is equally near to the Absolute center of energy. Because this energy is no longer in terms of place. It is truly in terms of being. It is azonic. Its center is everywhere. Its circumference is nowhere. If, therefore, we dabble with the atom or the monad, we are therefore dabbling with universal energy, of which the monad is the symbolic unit. Now, I think Leibniz had a point here that was perhaps theologically not acceptable to the people of his time, but which was a clue to his own insight in recognizing the identity of spirit, energy, and activity and force. That these are names for the conditions of one thing. Also, Leibniz postulated the concept that all of these atomic substances are immortal, for the reason that they contain within themselves the potentials of the only immortal thing that exists, and that is the Absolute. Consequently, all atoms can change. All atoms can be reduced or augmented in various ways, but no atom can be actually destroyed. Consequently, the only possible implication from this, in terms of our own theories concerning the splitting of the atom and the apparent complete disintegration of the atom, we are forced to assume, if Leibniz is right, that what we call this disintegrative process is merely the abrupt motion of the pattern of an atom from one level to another. That the atom is not actually destroyed. That the atom is not split, truly. But that in order to achieve the effect, it is necessary for the atom to move through an energy barrier, just as a plane going through the sound barrier causes an abrupt explosion. So an atom, by being transformed so that it is forced to abruptly move through a barrier between two kinds of atoms, apparently in this process, has to go through a quality barrier. And in passing through this quality barrier, there is a tremendous and instantaneous change in its own construction. And this change in its own construction is accompanied by a violent physical symptom. Now, this violent physical symptom, having occurred to an atom, and having resulted in a certain vibratory change, it is quite conceivable that this change now affects all other atomic substances keyed to the same level of polarity. Therefore, that in a mysterious way, all of the atoms of a certain kind are moved, agitated, or disturbed because they have one core. And if, for example, you take a reservoir from which a city secures its water, if you infect this reservoir, all of the people become sick. If you disturb the atomic balance or the monadal balance of a certain kind of atom or monad, then this disturbance is carried immediately by chain reaction through a vast area of this particular or peculiar type of monadal structure. Now, there's more than one type of monad. But according to Leibniz, after the effect of the disturbance is exhausted on its own level, the disturbance may continue upon other levels and continue onward until the disturbance is finally absorbed in the absolute monad, because the absolute monad must also possess within itself both calmness and disturbance. And no change can occur in the monad unless this change is archetypally present in the absolute atom. But now Leibniz is giving us a concept which could very easily lead into the realization that the atom is the key to infinite energy resource. But that this key is an extremely dangerous one, and a very subtle one, and a difficult one to control and direct. The question as to what actually occurs in the so-called fission of the atom is still not too well understood. A certain process seems to produce this phenomenon. But the entire reason is still obscure and is in a highly hypothetical state, subject to further revision. But the fact does remain that we know that something happens. We know that one of the most terrible combustions that we can conceive of occurs when this atom is bombarded, that it results in a tremendous change in structure. This proves also that every atom has an incredible energy potential. Now, this energy potential locked in the atom, according to Leibniz, is actually, in a sense, the future assurance of this atom. This energy is not supposed to be exploded any more than a great forest of trees is supposed to be burned by vandalism. If these things happen, the results and consequences must be coped with. But the purpose of this enormous energy that is locked within the atom is that this energy shall gradually move into manifestation through the ultimate development of the atomic resource of this atom. If we are, for instance, to assume that every atom is a potential sun, and as Leibniz pointed out, there is no end to the growth of this atomic body or being. The little atoms that we know today, so small that we cannot see them, may unfold into solar systems, may unfold into cosmic chains or galaxies, may finally unfold beyond anything that we can conceive. Why can they do this? And how do they do it? Simply because infinite resource is locked in each one of them. If, therefore, this explosion, which we see, and which can certainly mean only a small part of the actual energy of that atom, that this explosion might explode into growth if it was normally handled. Just as this great exploding cloud might for a moment appear to be a great tree, so this tree would represent the explosion of the acorn. The acorn gradually, quietly, and peaceably explodes into a great tree. This tree may in turn explode into a forest of trees. But each of those little acorns contains part of that energy. This energy goes on infinitely and indefinitely because this energy partakes of the unit of the absolute. There is no limit to it. But if it unfolds naturally in the course of a billion years, this energy may unfold into a magnificent structure. Or this atom may rest for a billion years before it does anything. But it is still potentially capable, under certain conditions and provocations, of beginning this incredible unfoldment in which it bursts forth into a universe. The only reason it can do this is because of the energy in it. Consequently, every atom, being the seed of a universal life process, has almost inexhaustible energy resources. Certainly, we have only released a very small fragment of such energy resource. But now, instead of a particle that was just a little bit of sand in the hands of a fashioner of things, we have the gradual dawning of the modern concept that the atom is actually a tremendous, vibrant polarity of infinite potential life, and that therefore matter, men, stars, and the universe are all forms of life rather than forms of matter, and that what we call matter is only our name for a kind of life, the activity of which is not sufficient for us to recognize it as life, that there is no such thing as matter, that all matter finally disappears in the monadal unit, and that this unit is primarily cosmic life, therefore susceptible of releasing cosmic life in various ways, constructively or destructively, under the various provocations by which this energy is moved. So we now get down pretty well to the point where we can start to think about a modern philosophy of atomism. And I guess our time is up, so we thank you very much.